Also, now, as Nip mentioned, the rest of the material on this broadcast, and we may very well go for the duration of this One Step Beyond show, is going to go into the permanent archives as basically an add-on to Radio Free America number 34, the sixth and concluding broadcast in the six-part series we did about the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to be dealing with information about the Iran-Contra scandal tonight. It also is going to update in a very interesting way some of the information from RFAs number 18 through 21 about the shooting of the Pope, and will intersect, in fact, to a still further extent, the shooting of Pope John Paul II and the Iran-Contra scandal. However, did you want to say something, Nip,
before I give
the summary of...
Go ahead.
Okay, now, a brief synopsis of the articles that we're going to be recording into the archive this evening. First of all, we're going to take a look once again at James Atwood, an associate of Frank Turple, an associate of the company, quote-unquote, an arms for drug smuggling ring, a figure who was very prominent in one aspect of the Iran-Contra scandal, and we're going to take a look at his fears concerning possible attempts on his life, where he did his banking, and then we're going to take a look at an article which will confirm something which we had been pretty sure of all along, and which is very significant, namely that the Merex that William Atwood used in the Iria arms deal, that's the name of a ship which carried the weapons, East Bloc weapons, to the Americas, was in fact Merex, the same Merex founded by Gerhard Mertens in cooperation with, among others, Otto Skorzeny, the same Merex that had served as a front for the BND, the final incarnation of the Galen organization, the Nazi spy outfit which jumped to the U.S. at the end of World War II. After that, we're going to take a look at an article which I'm sure many of you are aware of, namely the alleged scheme by Oliver North and Panamanian strongman Antonio Noriega, now currently on the outs with the United States, to set up the Nicaraguan government with an East Bloc weapons shipment, allegedly from the Sandinistas to the El Salvadorian guerrillas, which would then be discovered by, presumably, the El Salvadorian National Security Establishment, and would go to serve as proof of the U.S. thesis that, in fact, the Sandinistas were smuggling weapons to the El Salvadorian guerrillas. This then might have resulted in a U.S. invasion, or certainly stepped-up aid to the Contras. Following that, we're going to take a look at charges in the recent indictment of Antonio Noriega that basically he was cooperating with the Medellin cartel, the huge Colombian-based cocaine smuggling operation, which intersected, among other things, with the Contra supply effort, as we've looked at in a number of different contexts. We're also going to take a look at the interesting death of a George Bush advisor and former CIA, well, in fact, current CIA official, well, not official, consultant, who was, among other things, one of George Bush's advisors concerning drug enforcement policy. And George is certainly an expert on drug enforcement policy, having presided over such drug enforcement operations as the Nugent Bank of Australia for a while in his tenure as CIA. And he's an interesting fellow, and one of his interesting cohorts, the late Mr. Taberge, has passed from the scene at a very key time of a heart attack, that most ubiquitous means of demise for Washington officials these days, particularly when right-wing scandals break. After that, we're going to take another musical break, give people a chance to rest, including us. Then we're going to come back and take a look at another assassination, which may very well have been related to one aspect or another of the Iran-Contra scandal, namely the assassination of Olof Palme of Sweden. And we're going to take a look at one of the places where the investigators have stopped off, namely California, to interview someone about the possible involvement of an international right-wing anti-communist organization. We shall ruminate about that and the Wackle. Then we're going to take a look at the death of yet another figure in conjunction with the assassination of Pope John Paul II. And after that, we're going to dovetail the Mediterranean merry-go-round, as we put it, in RFAs number 18 through 21, the shooting of Pope John Paul II and the circumstances and institutions surrounding that with the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to take a look at a major, major breakthrough scored by Mae Brussel this past week, in which she took information from a translation, which in turn was a major breakthrough from our Italian translator, who's been doing such yeoman-like work, and she basically connected up Avni Musalulu, or Yasar Musalulu, as he is also known, a.k.a. Oral Chilik of the Grey Wolves, an associate of Mehmet Ali Ajaz, with the Pizza Connection case. He apparently was a major figure in that. That will bring him into contact with all kinds of people, including associates of George Bush, associates of Ronald Reagan, late White House chiefs of staff, E.F. Hutton, which when it talks, everybody listens. And if you want to find out why, well, it's tune in and stay tuned, because we're gonna talk about some of the things that E.F. Hutton's been talking about, including eluding FBI investigations. And we'll review once again Jha's allegations that Ural Chalik was indeed involved with him. It appears beyond doubt at this point that Ural Chalik was involved with the assassination of Pope John Paul II as an accomplice to Mehmet Ali Jha. We're then going to review some of the translations by our Italian translator, which broke this open in a sense, namely the alias of Ural Chalik as Avni Yasar Musululu, the alleged participation of Ural Chalik with the Drug Enforcement Administration, and in addition to the Avni Musululu, or Avni Yasar Musululu alias of Ural Chalik. Then we're going to take a look at Ural Chalik's association with Burmese opium lord Khun Sa, a fellow who, among other things, has been doing big-time business for a long time with Theodore Shackley and Richard Armitage, two of the defendants in the Christic Institute suit, two of the key players in what the Christic Institute has termed the secret team, a cabal of U.S. veteran U.S. military and intelligence people who've been up to their eyeballs in virtually every major national security operation of the past 25 years. This would bring Ural Chalik of the Grey Wolves and the Pope shooting directly in with Theodore Shackley. This article maintains that Ural Chalik is the European outlet for Khun Sa's heroin, and in light of Theodore Shackley's hooking up with Giuseppe Santavito of the Super Seize Me in P2 shortly before the Pope was shot, as the Pope was effecting a diplomatic rapprochement with the Kremlin, well, this is interesting that he would be cooperating with Ural Chalik in the Khun Sa distribution. Following that, we're going to take a look at Bo Greitz and his allegations concerning the association between Bo Greitz, a former Special Forces operative, current U.S. covert operative, and his allegations concerning Theodore Shackley and the Khun Sa association with Shackley. We're then going to take a look at Adnan Khashoggi, the key weapons dealer. Well, after that, we will take a break. Then we will take a look at Adnan Khashoggi and his habits, the allegations that he, in fact, has used beautiful women as espionage agents and to affect some of his business deals. We're going to take a look at that, speculate about beautiful Donna Rice and excessively horny Gary Hart, and how that may have helped overshadow the beginnings of the Iran-Contra hearings this past spring. We're then going to take a look at a man named Paul Skousen, the son of Cleon Skousen, a former NSC aide who may have helped shred some of Ollie North's pillow stuffings, the former cables that he used in his Contra supply operation. And then, just by way of showing that what goes around comes around, and sometimes discretion is the better part of valor, we're going to take a look at the late Representative Daniel of Virginia, his opposition to a key Frank Carlucci appointment, and his untimely demise. Well, perhaps not untimely. He was 73. That's reasonably old. But this was the first time in 20 years he had appointed a National Security Establishment nomination, and it also apparently was the last. He will not be opposing it anymore. Right. He'd supported all the others. He finally opposed one. He won't be opposing any others. And we're going to talk about that. That's what we have on tap for tonight. This will go in, if for some reason, like you're listening in your car or something and you can't tape, this will go in as an addendum to Radio Free America 34 on permanent file with archives on audio.
Now, those of you who have joined us within the last year, year and a half or so, and had a chance to listen to the Radio Free America's having to do with the Iran-Contra series, good for you. However, your work is not yet done. As we had mentioned several times tonight and during the last month and a half or 2 months or so, the what we call the Mediterranean merry-go-round is more and more beginning to lock up like a couple of large spaceships docking in midair. These two cases, the Iran-Contra case and the what we call the Mediterranean merry-go-round, what's recorded in the Radio Free America archives as the Who Shot the Pope series, are becoming more and more contiguous, and we would strongly advise those of you who did not get a chance to hear those shows to go track them down, because in and of themselves they're fascinating. Just the amount of people, their connections, the kinds of things that have been going on. But not only are they fascinating, but they are even more timely than they were a year ago. Because as we said, and as we'll talk about tonight, these things are beginning to come together and make some contact. So those are Radio Free America's numbers...
29 through 34, the On the Iran-Contra series.
Well, the Who Shot the Pope series.
Numbers 18 through 21, actually 17 through 21, which gives the background on fascism in the Vatican. So RFA 17 through 21.
Bingo. Okay, the first article we're going to read is actually a reprise, an article that we've read before, but we're going to be examining some of the things in it in a somewhat different light this evening. This is from the San Jose Mercury News for Thursday, December 31st, 1987. The article is headlined, Arms Deal Said to Profit CIA's Secret Companies. They're talking about a man by the name of James Atwood, who we've mentioned before. James Atwood, intimately locked into not only the company, meaning the CIA, but the company, an arms for drugs operation. And Mr. Atwood has been a lot of interesting places at a lot of interesting times, and yet again he has turned up in a rather auspicious or suspicious location, namely in the middle of the Iran-Contra case. This having to do with the transshipment of a group of Polish and other weapons that were originally going to the Contras and then later wound up being shipped around from ship to ship and profiting, and nobody except the folks working for the CIA and their contacts. Anyway, talking about James Atwood of the company. Atwood, the article says, who was granted immunity to give sworn testimony to congressional investigators, ultimately received $180,000 and 3 million rounds of ammunition as apparent commissions for the transaction. He refused to be interviewed by the Times. That's, I guess, because this is a Los Angeles Times story to begin with. Atwood also refused last week to disclose his finances to a Georgia court, citing national security and his Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. Atwood, who is battling a $500,000 legal judgment, testified that, quote, very real threats were made against my life for things I had done in the national security, unquote. I have to choose my words very carefully, he said. In the December 22nd hearing, Atwood's lawyer said, quote, a government agency I'm not authorized to give the name is very much involved, unquote. Skipping down in the article, most of the funds, that's the funds involved in this deal, this transshipment of weapons, most of the funds have since been accounted for by various investigators. One that remains a mystery, however, is a $180,000 payment to Atwood, an apparent commission for his role in the transaction. Despite a grant of immunity from prosecution, several reliable sources said, Atwood, citing fears for his life, refused to answer questions about the bank account in Vienna into which that commission was placed. Now, among the other interesting things, of course, we will talk a little bit more about the deal itself and some of the folks involved in this particular money deal. But, of course, what also is interesting is Atwood's contention that his life is in danger because of things he's done for national security. Now, in this particular case, one wonders who would want to take Mr. Atwood's life. Well, theoretically, if it were the, quote, enemies of the operation he was involved in, it would be the Sandinistas. Well, the Sandinistas don't seem to have bumped off anybody. As a matter of fact, the Sandinistas would probably be doing a lot better if they bumped off some of their Washington enemies, but they have not. So one wonders exactly who it is that wants to kill Mr. Atwood. Well, as we have often stated in the past, there is no honor among thieves, and the kind of company in which Mr. Atwood is running is not the kind of company conducive to a healthful retirement, and especially when you know something about an operation that has blown sky high. And Mr. Atwood knows not only that, but a lot of other operations that are somewhat dubious as well.
Now, in Radio Free America number 33, we talked about many suspicious deaths connected with the Iran-Contra scandal. Some of the mighty, mighty damn suspicious deaths connected with the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to take a look at some more of those this evening. And again, bear in mind the apparent fear of James Atwood of possibly coming to physical harm as a result of his role in this murky affair. That doesn't really seem, under the circumstances, an unreasonable fear. Among the institutions which were utilized by, among others, James Atwood in conjunction with the Aria deal. Reading the original Los Angeles Times story, which this Mercury News reprint was based on, and we're going to read a part of this story which the Mercury News left out. This is from the Los Angeles Times of Thursday, December 31st of 1987. It's by, again, Michael C. Rempel and Michael Wines of the Los Angeles Times. Dateline, Washington, and headline, CIA arms dealer sought to create, or CIA arms deal sought to create cash surplus. And skipping down in the article, we're just going to read a very short section. Again, this is the same article, although the Mercury News left this out. Atwood, who had never managed such a large arms deal with the agency, needed the logistical and financial assistance of an outside firm, Marex, a major West German trading company with U.S. operations in Texas and Virginia. A Marex shell company, Overseas Trading Consultants, was listed as the buyer on shipping documents, a role that would normally have been filled by a discreet CIA proprietary had not the transaction been so rushed. Well, this confirms basically the thesis that we've been driving at during our Iran-Contra series, and we talked about Marex both in Radio Free America 32 and in Radio Free America number 34. Marex is an arms-dealing firm which was founded by a guy named Gerhard Mertens and in combination with Otto Skorzeny. Marex has served as a front for the BND in trafficking arms to a number of people, including P2-linked elements of the Italian far right. And Marex has been used by, among others, Klaus Barbie, Friedrich Schmidt, and other well-known defenders of freedom and human rights. And it's interesting here that we have the confirmation that, in fact, Atwood was using Marex. Incidentally, Gerhard Mertens, the head of Marex, used to be the European representative for Samuel Cummings, one of the world's major arms dealers, a longtime affiliate of the CIA, and a fellow whose brother-in-law is John Tower, the head of the Tower Commission, which allegedly investigated the Iran-Contra scandal. So curiouser and curiouser. But again, this article, and research credit to this goes to a listener, by the way, confirms what we had suspected, namely that the two Marexes, in fact, the Marex in Germany and the Marex used by Atwood, are in fact the Nazi and BND-linked Marex used by people like Skorzeny and Gerhard Mertens for a number of different things.
All right. Continuing with some of the interesting information, perhaps knowledge of which might have been responsible for Mr. Atwood's fear for his life. This is a story that has not received a great deal of attention, even though it is a front-page story from the New York Times. This was from the Times of February 4th, 1988, and people are not talking in the streets about this, but they ought to be. The article is headlined, A U.S. Frame-Up of Nicaragua Charged. The article is by Stephen Engelberg with Elaine Cialino, or Cialino, as a special to the New York Times, dateline Washington, February 3rd. A former senior Panamanian official said today that the White House set up a secret operation in 1986 that called for Panama to arrange an East Bloc arms shipment that could then be captured in El Salvador and falsely linked to the Nicaraguan government. Okay, first off, and a quick insert here, note East Bloc. We'll get back to that. The Panamanian, Jose I. Blandon, B-L-A-N-D-O-N, is a former close advisor to Panama's military leader, General Manuel Antonio Noriega. General Noriega is expected to be indicted on drug charges by a grand jury in Miami on Friday, Justice Department officials said. Mr. Blandon said in a telephone interview that the deal was put together by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver L. North, the White House aide responsible for funneling aid to the Contras during the period when the administration was barred from providing military help to the rebels. Skipping down. An operation aimed at making it appear that Nicaragua was shipping arms to the Salvadoran guerrillas would have fulfilled the Reagan administration's long-standing goal of proving the Sandinista government was exporting its revolution. The effort collapsed in June 1986 when the New York Times published an article reporting illegal activities by General Noriega, Mr. Blandon said. It was disclosed last year that General Noriega had told Colonel North that he was willing to mount sabotage and assassination operations against Nicaragua, and that Colonel North had endorsed the idea of a sabotage plan, but Mr. Blandon's assertions suggest a deeper White House and administration link to General Noriega. I should point out parenthetically that, of course, this is rather interesting because right now the White House is currently on the outs with Noriega, and we'll examine that for a moment. Anyway, continuing, Mr. Blandón also told investigators that General Noriega, who took power in 1981, had a close relationship with William J. Casey, who was director of Central Intelligence, and once flew in the plane of a drug smuggler to Washington in 1983 to confer with him, meaning with Casey. It was not known if Mr. Casey knew of the plan to embarrass the Nicaraguan government. Parenthetically, I would add that we will never know, because Mr. Casey is no longer with us. Skipping down in the article. General Noriega maintained a close personal relationship with Mr. Casey, who died last year. Quote, Noriega said, definitely said he had the support of Casey, Mr. Blandón said. He said that on one occasion, General Noriega flew to Washington on the private jet owned by a convicted drug dealer, Stephen M. Kalish, for a secret meeting with Mr. Casey. Mr. Kalish testified before Congress last week that General Noriega borrowed the jet in November 1983. A former intelligence official said that after Admiral Poindexter sternly told General Noriega to change his ways in 1986, Mr. Casey followed up with a more conciliatory approach that undercut the admiral's message. The Salvadoran rebels asked General Noriega in late 1987 to help them buy sophisticated weapons, including American-made Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. General Noriega agreed to help and later contacted Ricardo Wheelock, a Sandinista intelligence official. Mr. Blandón said he was later told the weapons had been delivered, although he did not know for certain whether the shipment included Stingers or some lesser weapons. Skipping down. The effort to ship a large quantity of East German-made arms and vehicles to the Salvadoran guerrillas also failed, and it resulted in a series of confusing stories about the travels of a Danish cargo ship carrying them, the Pia Vesta. Mr. Blandón said he learned about the operation from General Noriega. The New York Times article about Noriega was published on June 12, 1986, and the ship carrying the weapons was seized by Panamanian officials 2 days later. According to congressional officials, the shipment was arranged by a Swiss arms broker who has ties to the French Foreign Security Service. Colonel North's notebooks do not contain a direct reference to the plan. The cargo ship passed through Peru on June 6, 1986, remained there for a few hours, then steamed northward to Panama. When the ship was seized, the bill of lading instructions were for the weapons to be delivered to General Adolfo Blandón, chief of staff of El Salvador's armed forces, no relation to José I. Blandón. Okay, well, this is a variety of interesting stuff. It's a fascinating article, and of course, it's the information is not going to be much of a surprise in terms of the basic thrust of it to most of our listeners who know that the administration has been involved in a variety of frame-ups, an attempt to sway Congress and the American people into backing the administration's war on Nicaragua. What is interesting is a variety of things. One of them is the involvement of General Noriega. Currently, Noriega is on the outs with the administration. Perhaps the administration was seeking to cut off at the ankles a rather disturbing story of this sort coming out, and so decided they'd better distance themselves from Noriega right away and say, no, it was all Noriega's idea. See, the guy is a lunatic. He's crazy. He deals in drugs. As Dave and I were chuckling about before the show, the idea of the administration pointing at Noriega and saying, what a bad man, he deals in drugs, is pretty humorous to the cognoscenti. Of course, the involvement of Noriega, the direct connections of Noriega with Casey are rather fascinating. And again, as mentioned, Casey not being around anymore to be questioned on these things after his sudden brain cancer. And also interesting is the appearance of East German weapons in an attempt to frame up Nicaragua. We talked in the past during the course of investigating the Mediterranean merry-go-round of the fact that the man who supplied the weaponry used in the assassination attempt on the Pope, an Austrian gun merchant by the name of Horst Grillmeier, was busted bringing a bunch of weapons from Czechoslovakia into Germany. That at first everybody said, oh, here, they're Soviet-made weapons. They're going to be used to foment revolution in Germany by the left, et cetera, et cetera. Turned out that these Eastern Bloc weapons were being brought into Germany by Grillmeier at the behest of the BND, the West German Secret Service. Also interesting in light of the fact that Grillmeyer had been used in the Pope shooting case to supply the gun to Mehmet Ali Agha, and the fact that the BND that was getting the guns from Grillmeyer in that case are also very heavily tied into the same Grey Wolves of which Mehmet Ali Agha was a part.
And bear in mind, too, that the BND is the fourth incarnation of the Galen Organization, the outfit that began its service with Hitler and perpetuated the ideals long after Hitler's fall from power.
So what we have here is a rather interesting series of things going on where we know in the Pope shooting that a lot of the weaponry was being dealt. The same person that was dealing with the Grey Wolves in that situation to get the weapon that was used on the Pope was also dealing with the BND. The BND deal with the Grey Wolves. We also had the fact that in this particular case here, not only is Noriega dealing with somebody who was getting him Eastern European weapons, but as we just read about, the CIA was dealing with Marex, which, as Dave mentioned, was founded in part by Otto Skorzeny, who was the head of Odessa, the Nazi in exile operation from World War II, end of World War II onward. So basically, it looks as if all of the weaponry, or at least it's possible that all the weaponry that's being moved around in the Iran-Contra case is being moved by expressly Nazi or pro-Nazi forces linked to Western intelligence. And from now on, I think that any time we see Eastern European weapons showing up somewhere, that flags should go up and bells should go off, and we should be investigating automatically much more closely.
Interestingly, too, the Marex deal, or the Area deal, rather, and not only involved Marex, it also involved Stanford Technology, one of whose units, International Imaging Systems, began under the auspices of TCI, whose head was Otto von Bolschwing, the head of Reinhard Galen's North American operation. A woman who was very close to him and who also did some work for TCI was Helena von Damm, later Special White House Assistant for Presidential Personnel. And Helena von Damm, according to one report, worked for some of Albert Hakim's subsidiaries. And these Nazi connections are worth musing over, not only because of the fact that our national security establishment in many ways grew out of that of the Third Reich, but because they were and are very cozy with these kinds of elements to this day. It's worth thinking about the use of East Bloc arms to create a pretext, perhaps, to step up the war in that part of the country, just as it's worth contemplating the blowing up of the Lapenka news conference of Aden Pastora to be blamed on the Sandinistas, to generate international outrage against them, just as the proposal to blow up the U.S. Embassy to Costa Rica and kill Ambassador Tams, incidentally, among other things, an opponent of the Medellin cartel involved in the Contra supply effort, and as we'll see in a moment, involved with Antonio Noriega. But again, that the Nazi methodology of provocation, not new to them, but employed by them and stamped irrevocably by them, by such masters as Otto Skorzeny and others that we've looked at, the use of a terrorist incident to be blamed on your opponent to justify, say, the dissolution of the German Republic, which the Reichstag fire was used to, the burning of the German parliament, blamed on the communists, in fact, done by the Nazis, the outrage at Gliwice, in which supposedly the Polish army attacked Germany at Gliwice, in which the Germans took some concentration camp prisoners, dressed them up in Polish uniforms, killed them and their Wehrmacht and SS guards, so it looked convincing. They had to have some German casualties. This operation was called Operation Canned Meat and served as the pretext for the Germans to begin World War II. So when we see these kinds of things going on, one of the reasons why we talk so much about the Galen Organization is that we find it touching so many different things. The Italian right, through institutions like Marex and people like Otto Skorzeny, Skorzeny not only working with Marex to supply arms to the Italian right, but working with the Rosa de Venti coup group, with the Borghese coup, funded by, among others, the CIA through Michele Sindona. We take a look at the CIA connections to the Grey Wolves through such personages as Ruzina Czar and Frank Turple. We'll talk about that later. But again, this use of provocation, the setting up of a terrorist incident, saying, look what they did to us, you know, ouch, quit slapping me, as I slap myself on the wrist with my other hand, and then I use that as an excuse to go punch somebody else. We've looked at that in the past. In a few weeks, we're going to do a show about the Han Mei raid, an apparent provocation connected with the Gulf of Tonkin incident. We'll take a look at that. But it's an old tactic, one which isn't new, but one which brings back, again, memories of the swastika.
Those of you with relatives or even friends, I suppose, active in Republican politics or involved in military intelligence or things like that, again, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, Mr. Atwood's alarm is perhaps not unwarranted. And take, again, not only Atwood, but take the example of Louis Tams, a man who was a Reagan administration appointment, who was a supporter of Reagan administration contra policy, but for one reason, perhaps, again, as Dave mentioned, because of his opposition to the Medellin cartel in Colombia, where he was ambassador or whatever, was apparently deemed expendable, and there was a plan mounted by Oliver North's secret commando teams to blow Mr. Tams up and use that as an excuse. So, as we said, there is no honor among thieves. Not only no honor, there's not a hell of a lot of friendliness either.
Particularly when you make such a handsome corpse as Louis Tams.
Yeah.
This is perhaps the most funerary of all administrations. Reagan, if nothing else, really handles funerals well. He knows just how to look sincere, and that compassionate look as he hugs the relatives, you know, and they have their, you know, they're at the risk of seeming a little cynical at this stage of the game. Because, you know, we've seen so much of this, whether it's, you know, the reflagged American coffins in the Persian Gulf, or the 241 Marines blown up by the same people that old rough and ready Oliver North has been diddling with in the Middle East. When we see people from the servicemen who crash in the airplane, the people from the Stark, it doesn't matter. Reagan is great at funerals, and he knows just how to hug those widows who, you know, they get their Andy Warhol 15 minutes of history and a flag to drape over the piano at home. And, you know, Reagan gets more votes in the next election. Very good funerary administration.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever done funerals the way Reagan does.
And Louis Tams, as you said, would have made a great corpse swarm. And I wonder what Mr. Tams, in the dark of his secret nights, thinks as he sits there in bed and realizes how absolutely expendable he is and how absolutely worthless the friendship of fascists turns out to be in the long run. One other thing that springs to mind, again, as we're talking about all of these various things about Merrick's and all this, again, to emphasize the importance of starting on the 15th, the replaying of the Radio Free America tapes, specifically the first two, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War. Now, excuse me, in 1984, when we first recorded these tapes, we had been on the air for some time. The Galen organization was kind of old news among a lot of our listeners. It was like, yeah, the Galen organization. We've heard about them. We're sick of them. We know about them. We know they were, you know, CIA Eastern Front after they were Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence, and then they were NATO Eastern Front Intelligence, and then they were the beginnings of the BND. We've heard it. Well, again, not to rub salt in any wounds, or not to pound people on the head with things, but again, these same people that we're talking about Merrick's, okay, founded by Otto Skorzeny along with Gerhard Mertens. Here's Merrick's right at the very moment that we were doing looking back from 1984, they're gearing up to get involved in this newest case. Here's Helena von Dahm. Here's all of these people linked to Otto von Bolschwing through Stanford Technologies and these other groups. Otto von Bolschwing, again, the head of the American wing of the Galen organization. And here all these folks are busily at work 40 years after World War II.
And one of the people, lest we forget, one of the people who was involved with setting up the European angle of this transaction of AK-47s, by the way, Kalashnikov assault rifles, was none other than a man named Manzer el-Kassar, an associate of, among others, Abu Abbas and Abu Nidal, who set up, among other things, the Achille Lauro hijacking. One of the prisoners to be released at the Achille Lauro hijacking, as we looked at in RFA number 32, was a top neo-Nazi named Ottfried Hepp. So these connections are very, very current and are not to be overlooked. The P2 Lodge itself, indeed, has many explicit Nazi connections, as well as Mussolini stripe Italian fascist connections. The P2 Lodge itself was headed up by Licio Gelli, who served as an Oberleutnant in the SS. Licio Gelli described as a good friend of George Bush, like so many other people are good friends of George Bush, including a fellow who's going to figure in the article after the one I'm about to read you, the late James Tiberge, who, like so many people who've associated with George Bush on one side or another, wind up being late. They're late for a very important date. And George Bush smiles and wimps onward or whatever. Not a man. It's funny that he has a reputation as a wimp. He does. He seems like a wimp. But let me tell you, this guy's no wimp. You just take a look at all the corpses around him. And if he isn't the fastest gun in the West, him being a native Texan, he sure as hell is the fastest Yalie in the West. No question about it.
Yeah, well, he's a... a slight variation on the Teddy Roosevelt theme. He sort of speaks shrilly and carries a big stick, and that stick has fallen on quite a few people, apparently, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Now, one of the interesting things about the recent disclosures in the Iran-Contra scandal concerned the fact that the Medellin, well, many apparently substantive charges at the Medellin cartel. The Colombian cocaine cartel, reported to supply up to 80% of this country's cocaine, was in fact very much involved with the Contra supply effort. Those charges come from a number of different sources, including informants for the Christic Institute, people who worked for the Contra supply effort, and a fellow who worked for the Medellin cartel named Mr. Mian Rodriguez, who reportedly gave $10 million to a man he identified as Max Gomez, who we now know was a man named Felix Rodriguez, an old anti-Castro Cuban, and a man who reported directly to Vice President Bush's national security aide, Donald Gregg. In addition, George Bush was very much involved with the anti-drug strike force based down in Florida, which, to the account of many, was in fact a major front for U.S. Espionage and intelligence activity in Latin America. Bearing in mind the allegations and apparent involvement of the Medellin cartel with the Contra supply effort, the late Adler Barry Seal came up with those same conclusions. It's interesting to bear in mind the apparent wrath of the United States national security establishment with Antonio Noriega. Reading from the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday morning, February 6th of 1988, this is a story by Stephen J. Hedges of the Knight Ridder News Service, Dateline Miami, headlined, Noriega sold out Panama, charges say. Panama ruler General Manuel Antonio Noriega was described in a federal indictment unsealed Friday as a corrupt leader who transformed his nation's jungles, banks, government offices, airstrips, and harbors into a vast clearinghouse for drugs and money that catered to Colombia's cocaine trade. The 12-count racketeering indictment claims that Noriega, one of his officers, and 14 other businessmen, drug pilots, and members of the infamous Medellin, Colombia cocaine cartel, quote, exploited, unquote, Noriega's substantial power for the sake of drugs and greed. It's a description which I think would certainly apply at least as well to George Bush and others in this administration as to Antonio Noriega. It's interesting that we should see this. One of the things you look for when you're looking at intelligence activity is movement. And we see movement vis-a-vis Antonio Noriega, his connections to the Medellin cartel, which also intersect with the Contra supply effort, and former vice president, or current vice president and former CIA director George Bush, a key advisor to Bush and a CIA personage, has exited the scene at roughly the same time.
Now, what is also interesting is the ability of the administration to, on one hand, be in bed with somebody, and on the other hand, turn around and basically throw them out of bed so quickly they don't know what hit them. A prime example, of course, is Edwin Wilson, who has been working for the U.S. Security establishment for many, many years as a CIA agent and as a, quote, ex-CIA agent, and has done all variety of vicious and nasty things, all of which ultimately benefited the extreme far-right stance of that part of the government. And yet Edwin Wilson wound up doing 51 years in, is supposed to do 51 years in a prison in Texas. Perhaps just because of being in the wrong place at the wrong time and the administration needing deniability. Now, when this stuff started to come out on Noriega a couple of weeks ago, I remember, and I'm sure Dave did too, saying to myself, well, this is interesting. Why is Noriega all of a sudden getting the swift boot to the butt? When people like Klaus Barbie and the Siles Suazo and Arce Gomez regime in Bolivia went on for years and years with the cheerful, one might even say frenzied support of elements of the United States security establishment, despite the fact that they were a government built entirely on dealing cocaine and fascism. Which, of course, as we've mentioned several times, have never been things that have been anathema to the Reagan administration. So I was certainly wondering, what is this about Noriega? Why is he getting the old heave-ho right now? Well, I think it's very similar to the Edwin Wilson case. And the fact this article that we read earlier about the attempt to frame the Nicaraguans is coming out, I think that probably that it just became time to get a little deniability between the administration and Noriega, and we're beginning to see that. Now, on this line about deniability, and as we mentioned earlier, the precept that there is no honor among thieves or among Reagan administration officials, we shall consider the, quote, natural death of James Tiberge, an ex-envoy, and a man with some rather interesting connections. This article is from the Washington Post for January 25th of 1988, and it's an obituary, in fact, headed James Tiberge, spelled T-H-E-B-E-R-G-E, ex-envoy to Chile and Nicaragua, dies.
This was supplied to us by Mabe Russell, by the way.
James Daniel Tiberge, age 57, former U.S. ambassador to Chile and Nicaragua, a consultant to the Central Intelligence Agency and an author and professor, died January 20th after a heart attack at Montego Bay, Jamaica. He was on vacation there when he was stricken. Mr. Tiberge served as ambassador to Chile from 1982 to 1985 and as ambassador to Nicaragua from 1975 to 1977, both sensitive periods in U.S. relations with those two nations. Since 1985, he had been Since 1985, he had been an international management and investment counselor in Washington as president of CORE International, an international management consulting firm. By the way, that is no relation to CORE, CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality. He was an advisor to Vice President George Bush on drug trafficking and a member of the CIA's Central Review Panel. Well, being an advisor to George Bush on drug trafficking, some folks might liken that to being an advisor to Captain Kangaroo on children's TV shows. Let's look at Mr. Tiberge for a moment. Notice, of course, that he was ambassador to Chile from 82 to 85. Chile, of course, was then and still is under the iron fist of General Pinochet, one of the arch-fascists of Latin America and a good friend of certain segments of the American government.
And George Bush, incidentally, was, as we looked at in RFA number 30, was director of the CIA when the CIA cooperated with the DINA in the assassination of Orlando Letelier. A number of the people who figured in the assassination of Orlando Letelier, including apparently George Bush, later figure in the Contra Supplier for people names like J. Stanley Pottinger, Frank Castro, and others, are to be found in both contexts. So it's worth thinking about the Letelier assassination, as well as the obvious connection of George Bush to Daniel Tiberge, or James Tiberge, rather, not of the former envoy to Nicaragua, who was headed up at that time by Somoza, and later an advisor to George Bush's anti-drug policy. An apparent heart attack, but as we looked at in RFA number 33 it was, heart attacks are something that apparently the Iran-Contra team were in a position to administer to people. Oliver North referred to the fact that some hostages in their control, one of them had already had a heart attack in response to Iranian foot dragging in the arms deal.
Now, one of the couple of things to mention, first of all, notice that his tenure as ambassador to Nicaragua itself coincides with George Bush's tenure as head of the CIA under the Ford administration, 75 to 77. Also of some interest, and I'll have to double check on this, but my recollection is that the Reagan administration envoy in Chile actually participated in like 84, 85, or 86, which is why I'm not sure it's Tiberge, in some anti-government rallies at the time that the Pinochet government was cracking down most severely on dissent, and the Reagan administration ambassador in Chile actually went out on the picket lines. I don't think it was Tiberge, but it would be interesting to find out, because if so, and if he was starting to have second thoughts about some of the Latin American policy or whatever, this could be another reason why sunny Montego Bay was the last spot that Tiberge stopped at on.